Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 5, Adaptations.
The purpose of Short Box Showcase is to talk about comic-related topics that fall outside of our individual podcasts.
I host the Quarterbin Podcast.
And I host Uncovering the Bronze Age.
But today is all about what makes comic books different from other media, and why some stories work better in some formats than in others.
This is a really interesting topic because there's this very close relationship between comics and film, something that I didn't really notice until I was about 15 or so and was really big on watching the special features of movies. And they always talked about how important a storyboard is for the finished film because it gives you a chance to look at the way characters are interacting in a visual sense before you actually have to spend any money on filming it. And now with the preponderance of comic book movies and movies that are based on comic book characters, that you already have a visual medium that these characters exist in that you can use as a starting point for those storyboards and for your finished film.
So it sounds like you're saying comic book movies should have an advantage. But can we say on average that comic book movies are automatically better than adaptations of books or adaptations of other things? Because I'm not so sure that's the case. I agree that there's this huge advantage that comic books bring. I'm not sure that's always manifest in the final movie.
Well, the advantage you get in the movie-making process tends to be negated by the, we will say, inherent silliness in a lot of comic books. The thing about comic books is that, for whatever reason, as a medium, there's a much higher level of suspension of disbelief. Maybe it's, these are just pictures. They aren't real people. But something that was really common in the late 70s, 80s, into the early 90s were the TV superhero movies, and even occasionally big budget superhero movies, superhero TV shows that were live action, and not very many of them worked.
So we're talking things like The Incredible Hulk, Shazam and Isis, Flash,
Doctor Strange, Spider-Man, the less talked about Red Brown Captain America films, and a lot of that is because of special effects budgets, that it's significantly easier to say, well, I'm going to have a 12-year-old kid who's going to get struck by lightning and transform into this giant Superman, lowercase s, and have him fight crime while still talking like a 12-year-old. That concept can be executed and pulled off well on paper. It's a little harder to do it when there are actual people doing these things, when you have to somehow create a lightning strike that looks impressive, rather than getting a piece of paper and sketching it and going, well, that doesn't look impressive. Try again. That doesn't look impressive. Oh, that looks really good. That's the one we're going to go with.
Two things there, Em. One, in your litany of less than stellar old school superhero movies and comic book movies, you left out David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury.
Oh, yeah, the Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Was that because it doesn't qualify as a bad movie? You think it's that good, or you've just blotted it out of your memory?
It's because I always forget it existed.
That's probably a safer approach. Second thing is, I mean, you did mention one of the biggest differences between comic books and movies, and it's actually an advantage that comic books have, and also novels, prose fiction, is that there's an unlimited budget.
Yep.
You can take your characters anywhere, time, space, it does not matter. Number of characters, number of scenes, number of locations.
You can have characters drop out for vast sections of the story and then come back later because you can just do a simple flashback or an editor's note. Whereas on a TV series, if a character were to drop out for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 episodes and it's not Game of Thrones, people are going to be confused when they come back. There's going to be difficulty scheduling that, having people come back to work for a 3-minute scene once a season. That's just not cost effective. It's not practical. So it doesn't tend to happen as much on TV shows or even really in like a movie series. If someone's in a movie, they want to be in all of the films. They want to be in significant portions of all of the films. Unless you're Stan Lee, there's not going to be a recurring minor character. Even Agent Coulson has become a full-fledged major character who had a huge part in the Avengers, now has his own TV series. Started off as a one-off character in two films, and by the third one, they were like, well, this guy is officially important.
Welcome to level 7.
Welcome to level 7. Oh my gosh, it comes out tomorrow. I'm excited. So that's your way of knowing. If it sucks, that's how you know that this was recorded before the episode came out.
Yes, because we're still excited about it.
Yeah, it's not going to suck. It's not going to suck.
Did you just knock on wood and make noise?
I did it intentionally.
And I think this notion of the unlimited budget, when really what you're all you're doing is drawing, or in the case of a novel, you know, using the words to paint the pictures. And I think that's one fact that DC has taken advantage of in their animated movies.
Mm.
That again, in animation, now you do have actors. So you do not have unlimited in terms of roles. You have to pay your actors. But in terms, again, of sets, of locations, of scope, the epic scope of a tale. One of the potential problems with comic book movies, superhero movies in particular, is that they have to be blockbusters because the budgets are so high.
Yep.
Because of the necessary effects. I believe it was probably on a Two True Freaks episode. I heard some podcasters talking about, you know, sort of what they would like to see from Marvel and or DC down the road. And one suggestion was maybe the next thing Marvel should do is do some lower budget movies. Some lower budget characters, sort of less pressure movies. Just, you know, stories that may be more street level crime type stories, an Iron Fist or something like that, Luke Cage, that might not require as many special effects or as many outer space scenes or CGI work, massive special effects budgets, things that are more manageable. The problem is I don't know that the movie companies want to release quote-unquote lower budget or mid-budget movies, so I think it's impractical. It's not going to happen. But it was a really interesting concept to not put so much pressure. You know, the Green Lantern movie bombed, yeah, but it did $120 million at the box office. But because the nature of that story is so space-heavy and its ring, it's so special effects-heavy, the budget was so high, it didn't have a chance to make money. It was almost unrealistic that it would make money because the budget was so high. I worry a little bit about Guardians of the Galaxy for sort of the similar reason. It's going to have a pretty high budget to pull off that type of story.
And the other problem for Green Lantern, I'm not going to say that it was a bad movie. It was perfectly average. It was fine. But the expectations on it were very high. And that partially goes back to the issues we talked about in previous episodes for the continuity multiple universe, ideas of who Green Lantern should be. Should it be Hal Jordan? Should it be Kyle Rayner? Who should it be? And in the film, they kind of tried to do a mashup of all of them and ended up failing on a lot of levels. But so in that situation, just the expectations of what the film should have been like and who it should have featured, even just at that basic level of what should Green Lantern's personality be, the opinions on what it should or could be were so divided, it's hard to bring that all together into one cohesive film.
And of course, from a very practical standpoint, a comic book only has to sell probably 40,000 copies to be viable, 100,000 copies to be a certifiable hit. And of course, the Green Lantern movie probably had 10 to 12 million people see it, and that was disappointing. The scale is so different on what you need to bring in terms of an audience for those different media to be successful, I think is an issue in terms of adapting comics to the screen and maybe even vice versa. We'll circle back around to what makes a good comic and what comic books can do uniquely to other media. We mentioned the sort of the big budget being one of those, unlimited special effects budget, if you will. But before we get too far down the road, let's talk just a little bit to define our terms. What exactly are we talking about when we use the word adaptation?
For me, when I say adaptation, the word that comes along with that is the word faithful adaptation. That if you make an adaptation that is not faithful to the character, you have failed. That's just the general assumption that comes with the word. So an adaptation is a work that takes characters, setting, plot from another work and transforms it into a different medium or maybe a slightly different setting.
Would that be different from, say, a work that's based on another work or maybe even inspired by another work? Is that the distinction you're getting at?
Yeah, basically that there's sort of a ranking, that you go an adaptation based on or inspired by, sort of in decreasing order of the amount of the original material that's preserved. So if you keep the characters, the setting, the plot, the sort of the mood, all that stuff, then it's an adaptation. If you keep character and plot, then it's based on. If you keep character, it's inspired by.
What if you just keep a color scheme and a couple of names? Then in a movie, they'll call it an adaptation or a based on or an inspired by, but it's probably just cashing a paycheck.
Yeah, most likely.
And unfortunately, sometimes that's what we get out of Hollywood.
I noticed this a lot about 3 to 6 years ago when there was just a massive amount of movies based on books. At the start of each of them, it would say, based on the work of so-and-so. And I would say, no, it's really not. It is inspired by. You're trying to make an adaptation, and you're failing, so you're just going to call it based on.
But here's my point, Emily. And a faithful adaptation does not necessarily mean a good movie.
No, it does not.
And maybe a looser adaptation might actually be a better film in some cases. I think about the Harry Potter franchise, where the first two movies are broadly thought of as probably the least effective of the movies. And one of the things that hamstrings them in the eyes of many critics and viewers is that they were too faithful to the books. It was almost the book on the screen and little else, and almost sort of going point for point, chapter for chapter, page to page. And a movie and a book and a comic and a stage play and a novel are all different media and have different strengths and weaknesses.
This is not to say that stories based on other works are bad or stories inspired by other works are bad. There's a new comic coming out called Watson and Holmes, which has Watson and Holmes doing their traditional roles of investigating crimes and bizarre mysteries, except that they're African American and it's set in modern day Harlem. But it still keeps a lot of the mythos, that there is still the aspect of drugs that has been involved in the Sherlock Holmes story since the beginning, the close friendship between Holmes and Watson and how they work off of each other. But in this case, Watson is actually the main character, that they have entirely shifted the focus of the stories. But it still retains enough of the original story to be recognizable, but puts it in a new situation that's still very interesting and hopefully well executed. Haven't read it yet, unfortunately, but I'm excited to.
And I think we would differentiate an effort like that, which is probably closer to an adaptation, as opposed to something like the medical TV drama House, which bases that character somewhat on Holmes. Even the name House and Holmes are sort of a pun there. And that, you know, clearly the creator does not deny this, that he wanted a medical-based Sherlock Holmes. Well, that wouldn't be an adaptation or even a based on. That's simply inspired by the character. And, of course, Holmes is an interesting case because he has been adapted and updated and inspired so many different types of stories, from The Great Mouse Detective to comic books to TV shows that take place in the modern day, TV shows that take place in the old day, the old PBS series from the 80s and 90s starring Jeremy Brett were very faithful adaptations of the stories, as opposed to things like Sherlock and, I guess, Elementary, which are more inspired by or adaptations in the sense of taking the character and attempting to put them in a different context. But I think for the purposes of this podcast, in terms of how we're talking, I think sort of adaptation, we're going to use it more as a catch-all for sort of all of these types of taking material and viewing it in different contexts.
In almost a counterexample to your discussion of Harry Potter, one of my favorite quote-unquote adaptations of all time is the film Ella Enchanted. I adore the book. It is an excellent book by one of my favorite authors, Gail Carson Levine. And the film stars one of my favorite actresses of all time, Anne Hathaway. And aside from the fact that the main character is named Ella and is blessed cursed with forcible obedience, nothing else in the two versions has anything in common with one another. The novel has these grand themes about femininity and the role of children and becoming an independent person, controlling families, difficult situations, and it in itself was an adaptation of Cinderella, hence the Ella. But the film is basically a love letter to bizarre, campy, faux historical. It is the modern world with a veneer of like Renaissance fair medievalism, and it is hysterical. So there's a moving staircase that is an escalator with some guy under it running on a treadmill. It's just, it's ridiculous, it's funny, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but I love them both. Even though the two have nothing in common, I can say that the movie is incredibly enjoyable on its own, regardless of its source material.
I did want to circle back around and just talk a little bit about what comics can do differently. And I think the fact that, as you said, you know, you can use comic books as a bit of a storyboard, perhaps, or that storyboards resemble comic book panels, that the storytelling of a comic book, a sequential series of static images, is very different from a moving picture. And part of it is in the aspect of time. And this is why something like a Spider-Man fight scene is just not as good in a movie. Because Spider-Man's quips and his comments are impossible to replicate in real time. Because in the comic book, he can punch, then spend a panel saying something funny, and then the punch lands. Or he can jump off a building and have, you know, a 15-second monologue on the way down because it's simply a static image. But those are manipulations of time, which is one of the great things that a comic book can do. And so it's tougher to do even something like that in a movie setting. And I think that's part of why the quippy humor part of Spider-Man has never really been captured. Because of its nature, it can exist in that form only in comic books.
Another great example of a way that a graphic novel handles the concept of time is the story Habibi, which I just recently finished and really enjoyed. I think that story really does an excellent job of taking advantage of all of the things that a comic book specifically can do. The story is set in a fictionalized Middle Eastern city, and that means that Arabic is the primary language of all of the characters, even though it's written in English. So a lot of times when they're speaking, the text will be overlaid with Arabic, or there will be asides where the author explains the way that the Arabic language functions, or the purpose of Arabic calligraphy, and things like that. The story itself is told in a non-linear manner, and it jumps back and forth in time frequently. Occasionally, even when it cuts back and forth in perspective, cutting backwards or forwards 10 or 12 years in between the panels.
And in general, that sort of time shifting is something that movies can do, but I think that works. That quick cuts in time and quick cuts in location is something that does tend to work better in a comic book form, I think.
And the story doesn't just cut back and forth between locations and between time, but the way that the story is paced takes into account that when you read a comic, you have the ability to slow down at certain points or to skim over certain points. So when there's a dialogue sequence, it's meant to pass very quickly, and the artist and writer uses very small panels to imply cutting back and forth in a conversation the way you would have in a film. But then a page or two later, there would be a full page, single panel that is very intricately detailed or has words overlaid on images, images made out of words, just very intricate art and writing combining together in a way that he knows that once you reach this point that you will stop and pause and examine before going back to the story itself, which is harder to do in a film because it's just not feasible to sacrifice 35, 45 seconds of film time to a single static image or one very intricate wide image and expect people to go up and investigate it. Because unless you pause it at that point, you're not going to have the chance to get up close and really look at the details.
Now that is an entire graphic novel, Habibi, is that correct?
Yes, it's 650 pages of graphic novel. It is a graphic novel in the proper sense. It's not a collection of shorter stories, and it's not a small novel in and of itself. It is a tome.
And it ends at the end, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
So in that sense, it does more resemble a movie, in that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. I think one problem with comic books are the serialized nature of them in terms of ongoing stories.
Which is actually why it makes me a little confused that there have been so many more attempts to turn comic book stories and comic book characters and superheroes into films rather than TV series. That there were several TV shows that we mentioned earlier, but I guess it probably comes back to the budget thing. It's very hard to make a TV show look good enough to pull off these characters convincingly. That's why I've got some high hopes for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So far, I've been a bit disappointed in the actual quality of television shows based on comics, though it should be a better fit.
Yeah, I do think the serialized nature of comics and the serialized nature of TV work, and I am man enough to admit that I kind of like the Arrow TV show. Despite the fact that it's on the CW and I am at least 25 years outside of their target demographic. It's not that bad a show.
I've been burned.
I mean, we say, well, there's no superheroes on TV. 10 years of Smallville. I'm sorry. It was 10 years of Smallville. It's Arrow. There are actually, need I say the three magic words to you?
Oh, no.
Birds of Prey.
We don't speak of Birds of Prey.
So there actually have been efforts, and obviously in the early days from Superman and Batman and even the Super Friends and Wonder Woman, there certainly have been many attempts, successful attempts to bring superheroes to TV.
That's probably why I like the animated series. You get the best of both worlds, that you get that serialized nature that you would get from a Birds of Prey, or from The Flash. I did like Lois and Clark. I'm going to throw that out there. Loved Lois and Clark when I was a kid. But then you still have that control and that ease of budget that you would get from an animated film. I don't know. I just want them to be good.
In whatever form they take.
Yes, just quality. Quality is key.
One case of a series of adaptations that sort of intrigued me or interested me was the graphic novel The Road to Perdition by Max Allen Collins, which was adapted into a movie starring Tom Hanks. And then there was a novelization of the movie written by Max Allen Collins,
who wrote the original
graphic novel. And I'm pretty sure at one point they were kicking around a graphic novel version of the novelization. It got very meta and very confusing. I mean, all three of those were somewhat different versions of the same story, and the same creator was involved in really two and a half of them. He wrote the first draft of the screenplay. But Collins was involved in, to some extent, with all of those different versions of his story. And I think as long as the creator is involved and even to some extent satisfied, I think that's always a good sign.
Yeah, I think that really is key, sort of author involvement. Now, again, this is not to say, you know, author is king in all things always, but it is appreciated even just from a fan perspective to know that the material was respected enough and that the author was involved enough, satisfied enough. It makes the whole process a little more palatable versus, you know, the opposite being, you know, World War Z. Very different film, has very little to do with the book, rewritten massively multiple times, not very much influence from Max Brooks, disowned the project at one point. Like, that's just, it's just not a good working relationship.
And actually, from what I hear, World War Z actually turned out to be not that bad a movie, albeit incredibly different from the book or the version that we heard, the audiobook.
Oh my gosh.
Which was a terrific, again, it was an adaptation of the novel into audio form. That, to me, I think that heightened it.
Definitely. And that's something that's interesting, is this idea of whether or not an audiobook counts as an adaptation, because it is being transformed into a different medium. And there are decisions that you have to make that are related to that. Are you going to have a single reader? Are you going to do what some books do and get two readers, one that does all the male characters, one that does the female characters? Are you going to have a full cast, basically audio drama, like they did with World War Z? Is it going to be an actual audio drama? Some of the first audiobooks that I ever listened to when I was 9, probably, were the BBC audio drama versions of The Chronicles of Narnia and Lord of the Rings, where they did a proper audio drama, and they kept all of the dialogue, but would change the framing slightly, add a few sound effects here and there. It's a very low production audio drama, but it was a proper audio drama with a full cast, and they were excellent audiobooks.
In a case like that, I think the further you get away from the original, the more it is of an adaptation, if
right.
That makes sense. That simply a single narrator reading might be an unabridged audiobook. Even in that case, the actor is bringing something to it, additional
right.
to it.
And, you know, and there are levels. That there are the single, there is the single reader audiobook. There is the dual reader audiobook. There is the full cast audiobook. One of my favorite series, The Chanters of Tremaris, The Singer of All Songs, where it's a single reader. But because of the story, where it's people accomplish magic through singing, for each one of the main characters, they have another person who comes in and sings. And whenever that character is using their abilities, then this singer's music is played in the background, so that when Kaylin sings, it's this very high, almost falsetto soprano. And when Darrow sings, it's this low, gravelly bass. They occasionally have musical stings, a very few sound effects. And it really, for that story in particular, being able to hear the music sets the tone so well. And I'm not sure if I would call it an adaptation or not, but it is an excellent way of presenting the book. I honestly wouldn't read it ever, because that audio version is just so good.
In the comics world, we've seen novelizations of stories, mm-hmm. novelizations of, you know, miniseries or events. And talking about audio, in the case of DC, they have a contract with Graphic Audio to produce audio dramas of novelizations of comic stories, if that makes sense.
That sounds awesome.
The ones that I've read are 52 and, I believe, Final Crisis, and there are a few others. The novelizations are written by Greg Cox, and then they have a full cast. It's a full cast dramatization of the novel, which is itself an abridgment and adaptation of the original stories. And I think they're very good. My understanding is that Graphic Audio has also entered into a contract with Marvel, so I'm not exactly sure which of those stories they're going to do.
That sounds fascinating. We've sort of come full circle in those cases, because Superman really sort of started gaining his popularity. You know, he started as a comic character, but gained his popularity as a radio drama series.
That's an excellent point. And there are some, I know, Superman and Supergirl audio dramas available through iTunes as, you know, delivered in a podcast form.
Interesting. Well, I think that is an excellent place to take a break, play a couple of trailers, and then we'll come back for part two, talk about what makes a great adaptation, what some of our favorite adaptations are.
And we're going to talk about some things that we would like to see adapted into comics from other media. And we'll do that right after this.
Welcome to Aboard the Night Bus.
Welcome to Aboard the Night Bus.
Welcome to Aboard the Night Bus.
What do you get when you mix two Hufflepuffs?
Gull, I want to go to Hogwarts so bad.
A Ravenclaw.
Oh, come on.
A Slytherin.
Like, I like my Hufflepuffs. Leave them alone. You want me to beat up Hagrid for you guys?
And a guest host.
Ollivander kind of creeped me out.
Well, I don't want to just say magic as the answer.
That is a good question, though.
Actually, it's Aboard the Night Bus, the new chapter-by-chapter Harry Potter podcast dedicated to taking a light-hearted and fun look at all things Harry Potter.
I'd wear my Slytherin kit every day.
From chapter reviews to character analysis, we're taking a not-so-in-depth look at all the things that really matter.
The trout. Your boga, it's the trout. It's a fish.
Join us each week for good discussion.
That's scary that, like, every conversation they have from now on is they have Peter Pettigrew there listening.
I'm going to argue otherwise, but you'll have to wait till I do Chapter 8 in our next episode to find out why.
A few games. Chocolate frogs. Pumpkin pasties. Every flavor beans. And a bit of light-hearted banter.
Does anyone get anything to add to that?
No. Not that I feel like adding at the moment.
Oh, okay.
Aboard the Night Bus. Subscribe on iTunes.
And we're back. Before we move on to our lists of things that we want to see adapted into comic books, we thought we'd take a moment and talk about some great adaptations and some of our personal favorite examples of adaptations.
I think in terms of current adaptations, there's sort of two superstars, one from a book series onto TV, one from a comic book series onto TV. You can't talk adaptations without talking Game of Thrones and The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
I have not seen the Game of Thrones TV show, though I have read the books, and that's about intense enough for me.
I have seen the TV show and haven't read the books, so it's pretty excellent.
From what I can tell from listening to podcasts and listening to reviews of the show and of the books, seems to be a reasonably faithful adaptation to the tone and to the broad spectacle, the epic.
Definitely.
Of the books, the Song of Ice and Fire novels. Now, you can't take an epic fantasy novel and turn it into 10 episodes or even 20 episodes of TV. There's just so much material.
Oh, no. Absolutely not. They definitely made the right decision there. And that's something that I think is important when we're talking about adaptations, is making sure that the adaptation matches the scope of the original source work. When you have an epic, sweeping, high fantasy, political drama like Game of Thrones, you can't do a 10-episode miniseries. You have to do hour-long, in-depth, long seasons, multiple seasons, in order to really address that sort of scope.
And from what I understand, they get the tone correct, and they get the basic concept correct. There are always going to be changes in character. There are going to be changes of a little bit of location or of making allowances for distances. That's a classic Peter Jackson in adapting The Lord of the Rings, that places were much further distance from each other than is implied in the quick time it takes to move within the movie. And I guess if you're a purist, you know, that could annoy you. But again, these are different mediums. These are different ways of telling the same or maybe what ends up to be a pretty similar story. And the same thing with Walking Dead. And there I have read the comic books up to the point where the TV show is. And I've watched all the episodes of the show. And I think, again, you have the tone correct. You have the location correct. You have most of the characters presented in a pretty faithful manner. And then within the world of the TV show, the rules of the TV show seem to be applied consistently. The fellas at Walking Dead Wednesday on the Two True Freaks network, Chris Honeywell, Sean Engel, and I think it's Bill Robinson is the third voice on that show usually. They've just started talking about the very first season of the show after spending a lot of time talking about the comic books. And I think they're taking a pretty open-minded approach to the TV series, which is the way I approach an adaptation. They're willing to cut it some slack in terms of some of those things we talked about before, about what a comic book does well. They're more bound to specific sets and specific locations
right.
than the comic book is. So they make allowance for it being on a television budget, etc. But I think that's a very good adaptation of that story into a different form. And one of the most popular characters on the TV show, Daryl, is not in the comic book at all.
Which does just baffle and confound me. I have seen one episode of the TV series and read an issue zero from a free comic book day for The Walking Dead, and I just cannot imagine how the story functioned without Daryl.
One thing about both The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones that also ties into what we were talking about before is the fact that the creators are involved in both projects.
Yes.
Kirkman is involved in The Walking Dead TV show to different degrees based on the season it is. And George R. R. Martin writes at least one episode, usually the key episode of each season. I believe he wrote Blackwater Bay episode in season 2, and I believe he wrote The Red Wedding.
Damn you, George R. R. Martin.
In season 3.
He feeds on our sadness.
And one thing I like that Kirkman said about revisiting his characters and his story in a different mode is that as a creator, it allowed him to take different forks in the road.
Yeah.
That when he was writing The Walking Dead, you know, he set the story in one direction. He had authorial choices to make, and he moved down one path. And he said exploring those same characters in that same setting again enables him the creative freedom to do different things. And I think that's really an interesting take. And I prefer when the original creator says that.
Yeah, when the original creator says, I love getting the chance to be more creative and take different opportunities with these characters, rather than the producer saying, well, it's nice that the author took those choices, but we're going to make different ones.
And I just do think having Martin or having Kirkman involved in those shows, even in a peripheral sense, I do think helps keep the tone appropriate.
Speaking of keeping the original tone when you adapt a work, one of our favorite properties and one of my personal favorite adaptations is the way that The Adventures of Tintin has been adapted.
And this segment of the show goes out to our English and European listeners.
And our theoretical Belgian listeners.
Unless Feedburner is lying to us.
I was a big fan of the Tintin animated series when I was little, and that was one of my introductions to the character of Tintin. My dad had been reading the Tintin books since he was a little kid.
But that's probably a longer story, the details of which might take up part of another episode.
Perhaps.
Short Box Showcase.
But one of the best things about that show was that both of us could watch it, because I enjoyed it because of the action and the adventure and the funny faces and the style and all of the great stuff about that show. And my dad was able to enjoy it because they are incredibly faithful adaptations of Hergé's original works. The art style is so close to the original books, it looks exactly like they had just animated the comic panels without it being cheesy or cheap. But Tintin remained a pulpy action hero and two-fisted man of action and willing to threaten guys with a gun. But it all came off in the same sense of adventure and fun and excitement and jumping off of trains and chasing motorcycles and just high excitement but really fun.
Because sometimes every boy reporter has to threaten people with guns or throw them off trains. It just happens.
Or get hit in the back of the head with a sap every single day.
And one thing I learned from Tintin is that every bad guy drives a Citroën.
Yes, yes they do.
Of course, The Adventures of Tintin was recently adapted into a big budget movie. What did you think of that?
I adored it because what's so great about that film, one, it's made by fans. If you listen to any of the interviews about the movie, Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg say how they grew up reading the Tintin comics and how that really shaped their views of what entertainment should be like and the importance of action and comedy combining together. And the film itself was made by fans for fans. You know, granted, those fans are multi-million-dollar blockbuster directors and producers, but the heart of fandom is still there, and it remains a great adaptation and a great film. What I loved was how similar it was to the TV series, because the TV series was so close to the comic series. In each transition to a new genre, it retained a lot of the core, but it also incorporated, for example, one of my favorite parts of the film is when we meet Bianca Castafiore, the Italian Milanese nightingale, an incredibly shrill and delightfully vain woman. And her voice actress is either the same person from the animated series or someone who is doing a spot on impression, and that is not an easy impression whatsoever. So that bit of retaining not just the design and the personality that was established by Hergé, but just even the mannerisms and the way of speaking that was established in the cartoon series into the animated film, just it creates this consistency between all three of them that I think just makes it a standout adaptation.
And it's one of my favorite action-adventure movies, and probably has my single favorite chase scene of any movie.
Oh my gosh, it is pretty excellent, you know?
And my only hope is that the movie did well enough worldwide.
Yeah.
That a sequel might eventually come out. But
I hope so. It is the second best Indiana Jones film ever made.
That is actually a really good way of describing the Adventures of Tintin movie. We want to move on and talk about items that we want to see adapted into comic books.
Right, because we are a fan of film and television and novelizations and all that. You know, we like seeing our stories in other mediums that we like. But, you know, if we could get a little bit of reciprocity, if we could have some of these great stories coming into comic franchises, that would be pretty excellent.
And I'm pretty sure this podcast is not called Movie Showcase. TV show showcase, because that would be redundant. It's Short Box Showcase. We are all about the comics. And Emily, you have our first adaptation.
All right, my first pick is a series of books, which I think would just make an excellent series of mini-series or ongoing series, maxi-series, anything like that. They are Spider Robinson's Callahan's series, starting with Callahan's Crosstime Saloon, and in particular, The Guy with the Eyes, which is a story that was originally published in Analog Magazine in 1972. It was the first story that Spider Robinson ever wrote and had professionally published, and started a series of short stories, which would eventually become Callahan's Crosstime Saloon. So I just think that taking that series of short stories and turning them into a comic series would be excellent. The comedy, which is so key to the series, is based around puns and wordplay and visual gags and slapstick. It seems like all of those things could be accomplished so well in a comic series. It shocks me it hasn't been done yet.
And I actually think that's an idea, sort of wordplay, visual wordplay, things. That's actually seems to me easier to translate from a book into a comic book because you're still reading the words.
Exactly.
As opposed to trying to do that sort of humor in a movie is a lot tougher.
Yeah. Because
it's based on visually seeing the words.
The only way that I think it could work if they did it in a movie, TV series, something like that, would be to do sort of a Scott Pilgrim almost, where you have overlays or where it takes a cue from Ultimate Spider-Man and has moments where the story pauses and we get a look inside Jake Stonebender's head. It has that sort of fourth wall breaking humor and self-reference, something like that.
Now, you've read more of the Callahan's books than I have.
Yep.
I believe you've read them all.
I have read all of them except the Callahan's Lady.
And I've read about half of them. And it seems that that series starts off, as you say, as really collections of short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then it slowly builds into more full-length novels, I think.
Right.
I think as an author, Robinson saw the promise of the series, and I think it sort of changed the tone of it. But that could work in a comic book form where the short stories would be your two- and three-story arcs, and your novels would be your 6 or 10 story arcs. And even the novels had these smaller sections within them that could be separate arcs. They just had more connective tissue.
Yeah, as they progressed, the first collection was just that. It was a collection of short stories. Once that book was published and Robinson started to get some recognition as a novel author, he started to realize, oh, well, maybe I should write things that are a little longer form. So the second collection has 2 novellas and then a collection of shorter stories. And then by the third collection, he basically wrote 2 very long novellas, stuck them together into a book, and from there on, they're a full-length, proper novels in each volume. I'm a huge fan of the books, but what's sort of ironic, I suppose, for this discussion is the way I found out about the Spider-Robinson books at all was actually from a Let's Play for the video game adaptation that was made by Legend Entertainment in 1997, Callahan's Crosstime Saloon. It's all voiced over, fully voice acted, and animated the best you could do in 1997 on a PC. But it also has all of the dialogue popping up on the screen so that you can read it and hear the puns. And the puns are all such an important part of the Callahan's mythos that being able to preserve them in a video game is impressive enough. And the fact that it was so well preserved, it made me go out and read the actual books, I think is just phenomenal.
Now, I first heard about the Spider-Robinson books at basically the same time that you did. I heard about them on the Sword and Laser podcast, as they were talking about Spider-Robinson and some of his accomplishments as a sci-fi author. And so there was a confluence of events where we'd both sort of heard about this short story collection and books from starting in the late 70s.
So number one for me, the thing I absolutely have to gotta see in comic book form, the Callahan series by Spider-Robinson.
So for my 3, I just picked 1 each from 3 different media. I have a book series, a movie, and a TV series. And since you started with a book, I'll start with my book series as well. My first thought for a book series to be adapted into a comic book was Stephen Lawhead's Pendragon Cycle, which originally was a trilogy, Taliesin, Merlin, and Arthur, later expanded to include the books Pendragon and Grail. You can probably tell from the names, they are Arthurian novels. And I thoroughly enjoyed them and thought that some of the visuals, some of the characters, I think it would really work in the comic book form. Except that Arthurian-type stories don't seem to do well in comic book form. I'm thinking of Camelot 3000 or Knights of Pendragon.
Yeah.
One was designed to be a 12-issue series, and the other one just didn't last very long. I'm even thinking currently of Demon Knights, though not specifically an Arthurian tale, has a lot of Arthurian elements in it, and lasted about 24 issues.
And to be fair, probably only lasted that long because of the violence and the action and the magic and all of the other stuff. I don't think it was the Arthurian lore, necessarily, that was drawing the readers.
So I think that Arthurian has been tried in comics and has come up wanting enough times. I went a different direction. Your choice, Callahan's, has already been adapted into something,
okay,
a video game, and now you're desiring it to be adapted into a comic series.
All right.
My book series has also been adapted into something.
I like where this is going.
Already. My first choice was turned into a syndicated TV show that ran 2 seasons. The 44 episodes running from okay to meh. The TV show was called Legend of the Seeker. And the book series is called The Sword of Truth by Terry Goodkind.
Excellent.
Now, this is a fantasy series. And in the same way that Arthurian doesn't always sell, in general, sword and sorcery doesn't sell. So I'm still out on a limb with this one. But I think this could work for a lot of reasons. It's a great epic story. There's some terrific locations. You've got keeps and temples and palaces, things that could be rendered visually in a very interesting way. The character descriptions we have in the book are of just beautiful, gorgeous people. And I think, you know, that could be translated as well visually.
It would be appreciated.
Exactly. There's fan service of every kind. And I say this as a big fan of the novels. They can get a little wordy.
Yeah.
They can get a little preachy at points, lots of speechifying.
Right.
And I think in a comic book form, you could edit and consolidate some of that down and really keep the best parts of it. I think you might have trouble visualizing the magic.
Yeah.
There are different types of magic and different types of powers and how those could be visualized in a way that they didn't just look like Spidey sense all the time or something like that might be difficult.
Though, actually, as I mentioned before with Habibi, I think that sort of willingness to go kind of out of the box with your designs could work really well with Legend of the Seeker because, for example, Kaylin's power, her confessor power, it's described as thunder without sound. And that seems like something that could be translated really well visually of just everything whites out or, you know, reverse images where, you know, all of the colors invert or things like that that you can actually get across way easier. Because that is something I appreciated in the TV series is that there was no sound, but it also meant that when you're watching an audio-visual medium, every time Kaylin used her powers, it was a touch on the lame side because you couldn't hear anything, which was intentional because of how it works. But I think that's something that could actually translate pretty well.
The model that I would follow is the model that Marvel has done adapting Orson Scott Card's Ender Games novels. That they've put out over the years about 60 issues. And the way they do it is they've taken the Ender's Game book and did a 10-issue miniseries. They actually split the book into two and did 2 5-issue miniseries. Mm-hmm. But it's a 10-issue adaptation of each of the first two novels and then different length adaptations for the other novels because those are pretty thick sci-fi novels. These are even thicker fantasy novels. And I could envision the 11 books in the Sword of Truth series each being turned into 8 to 12-issue comic books.
Getting a 110-issue run.
Yeah, that's 8 to 10 to 12 years worth of comic books. I think that's very reasonable. And I think that could be accomplished. So that's my first choice. The Sword of Truth series of epic fantasy novels by Terry Goodkind. Emily, your second choice.
Well, as is no surprise to anyone, you and I tend to have sort of similar tastes when it comes to our media. We both like superhero comics. We like many of the same TV shows, many of the same movies. So it should be of little surprise to anyone that I also have a proper fantasy series on my list. My number 2 is The Tortall Books by Tamara Pierce. Any or all of them. Tamara Pierce is a YA fantasy author who's been releasing books for at least a decade. I've been reading her books since I was probably about 11 years old, and I have loved them. She tends to write books in quartets, so if you want to transform Song of the Lioness, the Alana stories, into one series, no problem with that. If you want to do Trickster, if you want to do Circle of Magic, any of them, I would read them all. She sets many of her books in the mythical land of Tortall and its surrounding countries. It focuses on the quests of knights, primarily female knights, which is a big issue in her first quartet, as we follow the first female knight. They're full of action and sorcery, which, as we've said, doesn't always work in comics, but really, really should. The character designs are all fascinating and wildly different. She makes choices for her character designs that are very graphic, of Alana's bright orange hair and purple eyes. Things like that that really should be in some sort of visual medium, just to appreciate how different all of the characters look from one another. There are sweeping descriptions of these lands, battles, there are deals brokered with gods and thieves, kings and pirates. Excellent stories, all of them, and I think they would make great comics. I will give a shout out here to the Tortall Comics Project, which I did not know about this, and I am so glad that I found out about them. It is a collection of fan artists from DeviantArt who over the years have adapted chapters and sections of Tamara Pierce's various books into short comics. And last year, many of those artists, with the blessing of Tamara Pierce, put together the best of their adaptations of her various books into a single book. You can get it on Lulu for free, since it is a fan adaptation. There's no profit being made from it. You can get it for free. If you're listening to this, you should go and download it. It is excellent. And it's a combination of 30 or 40 fans who put together a comic book because, much like myself, they read these books and thought, well, this needs to be a comic.
That is a great response from a creator to fans wanting to do things with their work. And no, they can't profit from it because of licensing and publishing and trademarks and all that. But at least she gave her blessing to it, and I really appreciate that. So if you want us to do that, lulu.com, and what would we search for?
It's Tortall, T-O-R-T-A-L-L, Comics Project. It is worth every non-penny.
Just like this podcast.
Just like this podcast.
Not to engage in relentless self-promotion.
Oh, but are we doing this now?
But if I bought that comic from Lulu for free,
yes,
could I review it on the Quarterbin podcast?
I will not stop you. It just has to cost less than 25 cents.
Hopefully postage is not included. My second choice is a movie. Like I said, I have a book series, a movie, and a TV show. And I found movies the most difficult one because most of the movies I thought of had either been adapted from comic books or had already been adapted into comic books in various stages. And even some of the, you know, famous characters in movies, from Dracula and Frankenstein, and those characters have been adapted into comic books. Obviously, Star Wars and Transformers and so many movies have been adapted. And as a shout out to Luke Giaconetti.
Giaconetti.
Of course, the Godzillas have been adapted into comic books. And of course, all the superhero movies and so forth that have been adapted from comic books. I really struggled to find something that met the criteria of not having yet been adapted. So to the best of my knowledge, the movie Galaxy Quest.
Oh my gosh!
Has yet to be adapted into a comic book series, and it should be.
Oh, it should be. Oh, it so should be.
And the great thing is, you could go two directions with this. You could either do the actors, the cast, sort of sequel to the movie, or you could actually do the adventures of the TV show.
Or because it ends with the Next Generation. I want Galaxy Quest, the Next Generation comic series with Jane Doe. She's the best.
Or you could do Galaxy Quest TOS, the original series. There are places that you could go.
This franchise has not been fully tapped. We need to tap this immediately.
And in the same way that the Adventures of Tintin movie is one of the best Indiana Jones movies ever, I think we can honestly say that Galaxy Quest is one of the best Star Trek movies ever made.
Definitely. Definitely.
And I will also do a shout out here. I have no idea what episode number it is. That would have involved, what do they call it? Research and looking stuff up on the computer.
Yeah, we don't do that.
The Two True Freaks have produced a commentary for the Galaxy Quest movie. So whether you've seen the movie recently or not, I highly encourage you to download that commentary and relive the magic.
That is such a good choice. I'm squeeing.
And your final choice.
My final choice is a video game. Now, of the two of us, I am the bigger gamer, but I am by no stretch a hardcore gamer.
Well, wait, to be fair, I am a hardcore Jewel Quest player.
That is true. When I was little, there were two game series that were just the pinnacle of visual interactive storytelling, and they blew my mind. One of those is King's Quest, which is an excellent fantasy interactive story. It's awesome. A funny thing about it, when the strategy guide was made for it, they made it as a novelization of the game. So when you got the King's Quest strategy guide, it was King's Quest as a book. A similar thing happened to my other favorite game of all time, and my number three, which is Myst. It was first released in 1993, when I was a mere babe of two. This game blew my mind. The ability to tell this reaching, epic scale, but deeply personal story almost entirely through visual cues and puzzles and a teeny tiny bit of exposition now and then from one of three characters in the entire game was just mind-boggling to me. I've played the first three games, which is all we had at the time, and then several years ago was able to purchase them as part of the 20th anniversary package, which enabled me to play them again on a modern computer. I don't think that I have ever grieved a piece of technology so much as our old crappy Windows computer that we kept around until I was almost 14 just so that we could play King's Quest and Myst. And when that thing finally kicked the bucket, I legitimately cried. So having the ability to go back and re-experience those on now even higher definition graphics has just been phenomenal.
We've talked about some of these adaptations, the book series especially, that really fit into a long narrative arc. We talked about, you know, arcs and issues and so on. I think that something like Myst would probably have to be an OGN, an original graphic novel, because that would be such a unique visual experience. I think it would be a one-time, not a series of issues. Is that sort of what you were thinking?
Possibly. The thing that's interesting about Myst is there are five games in the series. There is a sixth game, but it's very different. It's more of a multiplayer experience. It's just a very different experience from the original five. That you could turn each of those into a graphic tome, if you will, or make a series of graphic novels out of those, or do the thing that we were saying before of have a series of mini or macro series and have 6 or 10 or 14 or however many issues per game that would come together to make a total of 38 issues for the four books or 65 issues for the five or however the math worked out on that. Now, another thing, sort of like with King's Quest, where the strategy guide was made into a novel, there was a book deal signed in order to produce Myst novels back in the late 90s. And they were released as the Book of Atris, the Book of Denis, and the Book of something. I never remember what the third one was. But I read them as a complete collection in the Myst Reader, which is, again, a tome. These three books together are about 700, 800 pages.
Are you talking about a comic adaptation of the game or an adaptation of these novelizations?
Either. I would be totally good with either one. The way that the three books work is that two of them are prequels and one is a sort of inquel between Myst and Riven. So if you wanted to go, Book of Atris, Book of Myst, Book of Denis, Riven, and so on, you could do that. Or you could adapt each of them individually. You could just adapt the Myst Reader into a series of three graphic novels, transform it as a whole into one tome, like Habibi, that, you know, you could kill a vagrant with. Whatever you do, I think it desperately needs to be adapted into the medium. The key is it has to be done with respect, because the thing about Myst is that if you hear the premise, you touch books and are then zapped into the worlds that those books connect to, that could be a little on the silly side. When you say that the game has only three interactable characters in the entirety of it, then people think, well, how are you going to get character development? How are you going to get dialogue? There's only three people and you can barely talk to them. How are you going to make this into a story? There was an attempt in 1997 to make an adaptation of the first Myst game in a 6-issue mini by Dark Horse. Unfortunately, only the first issue was ever published because as soon as the creators read the first issue, they pulled the plug. It just wasn't up to snuff. It didn't keep the same sense of mystery, the atmosphere, the sort of color palette and design of this very realistic, quote-unquote, world. A world that you felt you could live in, that has things that are ever so slightly off. Technology that looks just not quite right, that makes it feel sci-fi without being a space opera. It's not over the top, but the issue just wasn't able to live up to those expectations.
So technically it already has been adapted, so you have to come up with another one right now.
Oh my gosh, no!
Okay, just kidding.
Okay. There was a follow-up, and a missed number zero, but I've never been able to really find where that is, who it's from. So you were able to get two issues out of it, but I'm still waiting for the day that I get my leather-bound copy of Mist that I can open up, and on the front page I see the iconic image from the intro where you see the island slowly getting closer to the reader until you turn the page and you're falling into it.
My last choice is TV series, and anytime we're talking about TV series, no surprise that the words Babylon and 5 will come up. So that, of course, would be my first choice, except technically speaking, DC did about a total of 12 to 15 issues of various miniseries, and they may even have tried an ongoing at some point, with J. Michael Straczynski involved in varying degrees in all of those, comic stories. So that one, I had to take that one off the table, because it has been adapted already, and the problem with the Babylon 5 franchise, as Straczynski tells the story, is that Warner Brothers is just loath to do anything with that franchise, to allow JMS to do anything. He's wanted to do comics. He's wanted to do more novels. From a corporate perspective, Warner Brothers just wants to hold on to that franchise, even though they're simultaneously not doing anything with it. So for fans of Babylon 5, it's sort of frustrating that there is almost no expanded universe works at all. So that would be my first choice. My second choice, I think, almost doesn't count either. And that would be the TV show Castle.
Oh.
And I wanted to go that direction because I have a sci-fi in Galaxy Quest. I have a fantasy in The Sword of Truth. So I wanted to do something different. And when I was thinking about others of my favorite TV shows, I thought Storage Wars.
Of course you did.
Didn't really think that that would fit the comics medium quite right. But I think Castle would. Again, there's not been a long history of detective and police type comic books, but they are out there from Gotham Central and other things that Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka have written. But I think that Castle would fit in that. Unfortunately, the world of the TV show Castle is sort of a meta place. It's about an author working with the police department. And in the course of each season, he is writing and producing a novel as part of the ongoing arc of that season. And then between seasons, that novel is actually produced with the quote-unquote author being Richard Castle, the character. And they have actually adapted some of those books into graphic novels already. So it's not exactly the TV show being adapted, but it's pretty darn close.
I'd be interested in reading some of those. I've found Castle to be interesting because, let's face it, it's basically made for me. It has Nathan Fillion and... I'm sold.
I'm actually a big fan of the show. And I've read a couple of the novels. And they're fine detective mystery stories. They're very good.
From what I've heard, isn't there a bit of, even to take the meta-ness further, isn't there some connectivity between events in the show somehow slightly influencing the books, that some of the characters are basically characters that Richard knows and puts in his books, which are then published and put in comic books?
Again, it is very circular in that sense. The characters in the TV show are not the characters in the novel. The characters in the TV show are stand-ins for characters in the novel, and there are events in the TV show that do work their way into the novels, because they're, again, intended to be the works created by this fictional writer.
That's actually really fascinating. I love that idea.
I actually think it's a really interesting promotional thing that the production company and the publishing company does, you know, during the hiatus of the show. But since that's already been sort of partially spun off, the next best thing I could think of was Vikings from the History Channel.
Oh, I would read that. I would read that too.
Again, that's sort of a medieval history. It has the setting of a fantasy-type world, but of course it's historical, so there's yet to be a dragon. So even though it's a semi-historical drama, the action, the adventure, the characters, again, the visual, I would not mind a 4-6-issue Vikings miniseries to come out maybe every year between the series.
Yeah, I would be totally down for that.
So my three ended up being the Terry Goodkind's Sword of Truth novels, the movie Galaxy Quest, and the TV show Vikings. And Emily, you ended up with?
Spider Robinson's Callahan series, the video game series Myst, or any of its associated texts, and basically anything by Tamara Pierce, except for White Tiger. That's already a comic book.
And that's what we in the podcasting business might call a teaser.
I think it is.
Now, this is a topic that I'm sure our listeners have some opinions on, so we would love to hear feedback at relativelygeeky@gmail.com about what you would like to see adapted into comic books, what you think the comic books medium can do different from other media.
Not to mention your own criteria for what makes a great adaptation and what some of your favorite adaptations are. We'd love to hear from you. Please leave a rating and review in iTunes, as long as it's nice.
Remember, we're not experts. We're just family.
Catch you next episode.